Ryder and Jock McCrump were in the main workshop. They had suffered many setbacks. This was the third time in as many months that they had been forced to remove the Ibis's engine from the hull and painstakingly re-weld the steam lines. Then they had discovered that the main drive shaft bearings had also been damaged and were knocking noisily at even moderate revolutions. Jock had made replacements. From a solid block of metal he had forged and filed the half-shells by hand. It was a monumental exhibition of skill and patience. At long last, after all these months of meticulous labour, the repairs were complete. Now they were putting it all together for a final check before they transported it to the harbour for installation in the steamer's engine room.
"Well now, Skipper, I think this time we've got it right." Jock stood back with black grease to the elbows and his few remaining hairs plastered to his scalp with sweat. "This time I think the old Ibis will be able to carry us out of this godforsaken hellhole. There is a shebeen in Aswan run by a lass from Glasgow, a lady of my acquaintance. She sells genuine malt from the Isle of Ely. I would fain have the taste of it on me tongue again. It is the true nectar of the Almighty, and that's no blasphemy, mind."
"I will buy the first round," Ryder promised.
"And the rest," Jock told him. "You haven't paid me this year past."
Ryder was about to protest the injustice of this accusation, but he heard racing footsteps coming across the compound and Saffron's breathless squeaks.
"Ryder, come quickly!"
Ryder stepped to the doorway. "What is it, Saffron?" She was holding her skirts high, and her hat was hanging down her back on its ribbon. Her face was flushed scarlet.
"Something terrible is happening. Rebecca has sent me to call you. Hurry!"
She grabbed his hand and pulled him with her. They ran towards the cauldron yard.
"Can you hear it?"
Saffron stopped and held up her hand.
"Now can you hear?"
It was faint babble and murmur, like wind in trees or a distant waterfall.
"Yes, but what is it?" "Our women say it's a huge crowd of the people. They are coming from the arsenal. Our women say that the grain rations have been cut again, and there's going to be terrible trouble. They're terrified, and they're running away."
"Saffron, go and fetch Rebecca and Amber."
"Amber's not here. She's sulking in the palace. She's not come back since she heard that Captain Ballantyne had gone away."
"Good. She'll be safe there. Let the women go if they want to. Bring Rebecca, Nazira, and any others who want to stay to the blockhouse. You know how to shutter the windows and bar the doors. You also know where the rifles are kept. You and Rebecca arm yourselves and wait for me there."
"Where are you going?"
"To call the men. That's enough questions. Now run." It was for just this sort of trouble that Ryder had fortified the compound. The walls were high and solid, and the tops were lined with shards of broken glass. He had designed the interior of the compound as a series of courtyards, each of which could be defended. But when one was overrun, they could fall back into the next. In the centre, the blockhouse comprised his private quarters, treasury, and arsenal. All the windows and doors could be covered with heavy shuttering. The walls were pierced with loopholes for rifle fire, and the reed roof was heavily plastered with river clay to render it fireproof. The first line of defence was the outer wall with its heavy gates at the front and the rear. He sent Jock with three men to barricade the rear gates and stand guard there. Then Ryder took Bakshit and five of his most reliable men to the front gates, which opened onto the narrow street. They were all armed with long wooden staves. Ryder made certain the gates were bolted and the heavy timber bars were in their slots. It would take a battering ram to break them down. There was a low wicket gate in the wall to one side, wide enough to admit one man at a time. Ryder stepped through it. The city street was empty, except for a few of the women from the greencake kitchens. They were scurrying away like frightened chickens, and within seconds the last had disappeared. Ryder waited. He was deliberately carrying nothing more provocative than the wooden staff. A rifle was worse than useless against a mob. A single shot might drop one person, but would merely infuriate the rest, and they would be on him before he could reload. A certain way to get yourself torn to pieces, he thought, and leant casually on the staff, assuming a calm, relaxed pose. The noise of the crowd was nearer now, becoming louder as he listened. He knew what that keening chorus of women's voices meant. They were whipping themselves and their menfolk into a frenzy. He stood alone in front of the gates,
and the sound built up into a muted roar, coming down on him like the wild waters of a river in flash flood. Suddenly the front rank of the mob burst into view 200 paces down the narrow street from where he stood. They saw him and faltered. The hubbub subsided gradually, and a strange hush fell over them. They knew him well, and his reputation was formidable. "Damn me if I don't do a Gordon on them," Ryder smiled inwardly. Chinese Gordon was famous for the hypnotic power he could wield over a tribe of hostile savages. It was said he could calm and control them by the sheer power of his personality and the gaze of his steely blue eyes. Ryder straightened until he stood tall and glowered at them with all the ferocity he could command. He knew that they looked upon green or blue eyes as those of the devil. The hush became silence. For the moment it was a standoff. It needed but a small push to topple it one way or the other. He started to walk towards them. Now he held the stave threateningly and paced with calculated menace. They backed off slowly before his approach. One looked back over his shoulder. They were on the point of breaking. Suddenly, a tall, gangling female figure bounded into the alley. Her features were withered with starvation. Her lips had shrunk back to expose bone-white teeth too large for her pale pink gums, which were studded with open ulcers. She was the harpy of mythology, swathed in black cloth, as she danced towards him, her shanks beneath the black skirts were thin as the legs of a heron, and her enormous feet flapped like the carcasses of stranded black catfish. She threw back her head and emitted the cry of a banshee. The mob behind her roared and poured after her, filling the alley. Ryder held up his right hand in a placatory gesture. "I will give you whatever you want," he shouted. "Stop!" His voice was drowned by the wild shrieks of the harpy. "We have come to take what we want, and we will kill all who stand in our way!" Slowly, Ryder lifted his left hand and made the sign of the evil eye. He pointed at the woman's face and saw her eyelids flutter as she recognized the sign. She stumbled and checked, but then she gathered herself and leapt forward again. He saw the madness in her gaze and knew she was too far gone to respond even to the most dire witchcraft. Still he stood his ground until she was almost upon him. Then he stepped forward to meet her and drove the point of his staff into her midriff just below the ribcage. The spleens of most river dwellers were swollen with malaria. A blow like that could burst the organ and kill or maim. The harpy dropped like a bundle of black rags, but the leading ranks of the mob leapt over her body. The man in the forefront swung a broadsword at Ryder's head. He ducked and darted back through the wicket gate. Bakshit slammed and bolted it behind him. They heard and felt the impact as the mob crashed into it on the far side. "We will let them through the gate one at a time, and we can crack their skulls as they come through," Bakshit suggested. "Too many," Ryder shook his head. "I will climb to the top of the gate and try to reason with them." "You cannot reason with a pack of rabid dogs." Somebody was tugging insistently at his coattails, and Ryder tried to pull away. Then he looked back. "I thought I told you to stay in the blockhouse," he exclaimed angrily. "I brought you this." Saffron held up his gun belt, with the holstered revolver dangling from it, and the rows of brass cartridges in their loops. "Good girl." He strapped it on. "But now get back to the blockhouse and stay there." He did not watch her to make sure she had gone, but turned back to Bakshit. "Fetch the long ladder from the workshop." They placed it against the wall. Hand over hand, Ryder shot to the top and looked down into the street. The length and breadth of it was filled with humanity. He picked out the harpy he had felled. She was on her feet again, doubled over and hobbling with pain, but her voice was as shrill and strident as before. She was directing the crowd to gather anything that would burn from the buildings that lined the street. They were dragging out balks of timber, dried palm fronds, old furniture, rubbish, and piling it against the outside of the compound gates. "Hear me, citizens of Khartoum," Ryder shouted in Arabic. "Let the peace and wisdom of God guide you. There is nothing within these walls that I will not give you gladly." They looked upon him uncertainly as he balanced at the top of the ladder. "There is the disciple of Shaitan," the harpy screamed. "The infidel, look at him, the pork-eater. the brewer of the Green Manor from hell.
She shuffled into a painful dance, and behind her the crowd growled. They threw stones and sticks at him, but the wall was high, and the range was long. The missiles hit the wall and bounced back, clattering in the dusty street.
What you call the Devil's Manor is cooked grass and reeds. If you will feed them with it, your children will thrive and regain their health. He lies! These are the falsehoods that the devil has placed in his mouth. We know you are eating bread and meat, not grass. Within these walls you have durra and meat. Give it to us. Give us your animals. Give us the durra you have in your warehouse.
I have no durra.
He lies, screeched the harpy. Bring fire. We will burn him out of this nest of evil and sacrilege.
Wait, Ryder shouted. Hear me.
But the roar of the crowd drowned his voice. One of the women ran up the crowded street. She was carrying a lighted torch, a bundle of rags soaked in pitch tied to a broomstick. A thick, black, tarry smoke billowed from the flames. She handed the torch to one of the men, who ran with it to the gate. Ryder glanced down in alarm as he realized how high the rubbish had been piled against the main gates. The man threw the smoking torch on top of the bonfire. It rolled halfway down, then stuck. In the dry desert air, the flames caught at once and licked upwards. The gates had stood in the sun for many years. Even though Ryder had his people paint them regularly, the wood dried out and cracked faster than they could repair it, and now the dried paint flared and the flames shot high. They were almost colourless in the bright sunlight. Ryder considered ordering Bakshit and his men to form a bucket chain to douse the flames before they could burn through the gates, then realized that there were neither enough men nor buckets, that the river and the well were too far, and the flames were already leaping higher than the top of the wall. The heat was intense and drove him off the ladder.
Bakshit, we could fight them here, but I don't want any shooting. I don't want to kill anybody.
It is me that I am worried about, Effendi. I don't want to be killed either. Bakshit replied. These are animals, mad animals.
They are starving, and they have been driven to this.
Should I send one of the men with a message to Gordon, to bring the soldiers to drive them away? Bakshit asked hopefully.
Ryder smiled grimly.
Gordon Pasha is not our friend. He values us only for our durra and our camels. If you send one of our men out there, the mob will tear into pieces. I think we'll be forced to save ourselves without the help of Gordon Pasha.
How will you do that? Bakshit asked simply.
We must fall back to the main compound. They'll not be able to burn that gate. The fire hose will reach it.
He had to raise his voice above the howls and shouts of the crowd in the street outside and the crackle of the flames.
Come, follow me.
The paint on the inside of the gate was already charring. He ran back to the inner gate and gave orders to have the water pump and fire hose rigged. There was a firing platform along the top of the inner wall, and reluctantly Ryder issued Martini Henry rifles to those who could handle them. Apart from Rebecca and Jock, he had trained only five of his men, including Bakshit. The Arabs took little interest in musketry and showed even less aptitude for it. Rebecca could outshoot most of them. He left the women and Jock in the blockhouse, guarding the loopholes. From the firing parapet, he watched the main gate sag slowly inwards, then crashed to the dusty earth in a final burst of sparks and burning fragments. The mob poured through, leaping and pushing each other over the still flaming remnants of the gates. One of the older women lost her footing and fell into the flames. They caught at once in her voluminous robe. The rest of the crowd ignored her agonized shriek, and within seconds she lay still. Smell of her roasting flesh floated sickeningly to where Ryder stood on the parapet of the inner wall. Once the leaders were inside, they came up short. They were in unfamiliar territory, and they looked about curiously. Then they caught sight of the row of heads above the parapet of the inner wall, and the hunting chorus went up again. They charged straight at the inner gate like a pack of savage hounds. Ryder let them get halfway across, then fired into the hard-packed clay in front of the leaders. The bullet kicked up a spray of dust and gravel, then ricocheted away over their heads. It stopped them short, and they milled indecisively.
"Don't come closer," he shouted. "I will kill the next one who comes."
Some turned and started to creep away. Then the harpy hobbled through to the front. She broke once more into her grotesque dance. From somewhere she had armed herself with a cowtail fly switch. She brandished this as she screeched her threats and curses at the men on the parapet. "You foul and stupid old woman," Ryder muttered in frustration and despair. "Don't force me to kill you." He fired at her feet, and when the bullet kicked up dirt under her, she leapt into the air, flapping the black wings of her robe like an ancient crow taking flight. The crowd howled again. She hit the ground and came straight on towards the inner wall. Ryder levered another round into the breach and fired. Again she jumped high, and the men behind her imitated her, laughing. The sound had a deranged, obscene quality that was as menacing as the shouts of rage had been. "Stop!" Ryder muttered. "Please stop, you stupid old bitch!" He shot again, but now the mob had realized he would not shoot to kill, and lost all fear. They came on after the prancing figure, in a swarm. They reached the gate and beat against it with the weapons they carried and their bare hands.
"Wood!" shouted the harpy. "Bring more wood!"
They ran to fetch it, and came back to pile it against the gate as they had done before.
"Get the pump started," Ryder shouted,
and two men seized the handles and swung them up and down. The empty canvas hose, laid out across the yard, swelled and hardened as the pressure built up, and a powerful stream of river water spurted from the nozzle. Two men on the parapet pointed it down onto the kindling below. It struck with such force that the pile tumbled over.
"Aim at her,"
Ryder pointed out the harpy. The stream hit her full in the chest and knocked her backwards. She struck the ground on her shoulder blades and rolled. The hose stream followed her. Every time she regained her feet, it knocked her down again. At last she crawled out of range on hands and knees. Ryder turned the hose on the men in the front of the crowd, and they scattered. Then they spread out to search the other buildings of the compound, which lay outside the inner fortifications. Within minutes, Ryder heard hammering and banging coming from the direction of his warehouses.
"They are smashing down the doors of the ivory storeroom," Bakshit shouted. "We must stop them."
"A thousand of them, and 10 of us?" Ryder did not have to say more.
"But the ivory and the skins?"
Bakshit was entitled to a small share of Ryder's profits, and now, as he thought of his losses, his face was a pattern of dismay.
"They can have the elephant teeth and the animal skins, rather than my own teeth and skin," Ryder said. "Anyway, they cannot eat ivory. Perhaps when they find no durra in the stores, they will lose interest."
It was a vain hope, and he knew it. It was not long before the men were streaming back, egged on by the wild ululations of the women. They were carrying some of the largest elephant tusks and bundles of sun-dried animal skins. They piled these at the foot of the wall. Their intention was clear. They were building a ramp to scale the wall. Immediately, Ryder ordered the men on the hose to direct the stream onto the pile. The tusks and the heavy bales were much more solid than the rubbish they had used in their first attempt, and the hose stream made no impression upon them. Then they tried to drive off the men, but although the hose beat down on them, most stayed on their feet and placed more tusks on the growing ramp. When one was knocked down, three others rushed forward to take his place. They kept piling up the heavy material until it reached just below the top of the wall. Then they reassembled in the outer courtyard, out of range of the fire hose. The black harpy pranced among them.
"You should have hit her harder," Bakshit muttered darkly. "Or better still, you should have put a bullet through that ugly head. It's still not too late."
He lifted the Martini Henry and aimed it over the top of the parapet.
"She is in no danger with you doing the shooting," Ryder remarked.
Despite the hours of instruction he had lavished on Bakshit, he was a long way from mastering the art of musketry. Bakshit looked pained at the insult, but he lowered the rifle.
"See? The old witch is picking out the best men to climb the walls."
Bakshit was right. Somehow she had kept hold of the switch, even when the hose had hit her squarely. It was secured round her wrist by a loop of rawhide. She was moving among the crowd and marking the ones she chose by slapping them in the face with it. Quickly she picked out 30 or 40 of the youngest and strongest. Many were armed with broadswords or axes. Encouraged by the harpy, the women started that dreadful cacophony again. The assault troop brandished their weapons and rushed at the wall. The jet of water from the hose struck the leaders, but they linked arms to support each other.
"Let us shoot, Effendi," Bakhshid pleaded. "They are so close, even I cannot miss."
"I would not give odds on that," Ryder grunted. "But hold your fire. If we kill just one, they will go berserk and start a massacre." He was thinking of the women in the blockhouse. Little else mattered. Even with the hose playing over them, the attackers climbed swiftly to the parapet. Ryder and his men checked them there, swinging at their heads with clubs and staves. They had the advantage of height. At a range of only a few feet, the fire hose was almost irresistible, and the long staves kept the attackers from getting close enough to use their swords. But when some lost heart and retreated down the ramp of bales and tusks, the harpy was at the bottom to meet them, lashing their faces with the switch and screaming abuse. Three times they fell back, and each time she sent them up again.
"They are giving up," Bakhshid panted. "They are losing heart."
"I hope Allah is listening to you," Ryder said, and plied his staff, cracking it across the temple of the man in front of him. He rolled down the ramp and lay still at the bottom. Even the harpy's stinging blows with the switch could not rouse him. Then a man pushed through the throngs of ululating women. He walked with the rolling, long-armed gait of a silver-backed gorilla bull. His head was round, shaven, and shiny as a cannonball. His skin was the colour of anthracite, and his features were Nubian, with thick lips and a wide, flattened nose. He had stripped to his loincloth, and the muscles of his chest bulged under the oiled skin and writhed like a black silk bag of pythons.
"I know this one," Bakhshid croaked huskily. "He is a famous wrestler from Dongola. They call him the Bone Cruncher. He is dangerous."
The Nubian climbed the ramp with astonishing agility. Ryder ran down the platform to confront him, but he was already at the parapet. He raised himself to his full height, balanced like an ebony colossus. Ryder placed the butt of the long stave under his arm like a lance and ran at him. The sharpened point caught the Nubian in the centre of his chest and snagged in his flesh. Ryder threw his weight behind it, and the Nubian hovered at the point of balance, his arms windmilling, body arched backwards. Bakhshid sprang to Ryder's side, and the two threw their combined weight on the staff. The Nubian went over like an avalanche of black rock. He tumbled into five men behind him, and they tumbled down the steep incline of the ramp in a confused jumble of arms and legs. The Nubian hit the sun-baked earth on the back of his shaven head, and the impact reverberated like the fall of a lightning-blasted mahogany tree. He lay quiescent, mouth agape, and thunderous snores echoed up his throat. The harpy jumped onto his chest and lashed at his face. The Nubian opened his eyes and sat up. He swatted her away with the back of one hand and shook his head groggily. Then he saw Ryder and Bakhshid grinning down at him. He threw back his head, bellowed like a bull buffalo in a pitfall, then groped for his sword, lurched to his feet, and charged straight back up the ramp.
"Sweet mother of God," said Ryder, "just look at him come."
He raised the staff again, and as the Nubian reached the top, he thrust at him again, viciously. With a flick of the blade, the Nubian lopped 2 feet off the end. Ryder stabbed at him again with the butt. The Nubian cut again, backhanded, and left Ryder with a stump no longer than his arm. Ryder hurled it at him. It struck the Nubian in the centre of his sloping forehead. He blinked and roared again, then came over the top of the parapet, hacking wildly.
"Back to the blockhouse," Ryder yelled, as he ducked under the blade.
Suddenly he realized he was alone on the parapet. The others had anticipated his order and taken themselves off at top speed. He dived down the rickety ladder into the yard and raced for the door. He could hear the Nubian close behind him, and the swish of his sword fanned the short, sweaty hairs on the back of his neck.
"Run, Ryder! He's right behind you!"
Saffron shrilled from one of the loopholes.
"Shoot him! I gave you your gun. Why don't you shoot?"
In theory, it was good advice. But if he lost even a second in loosening the flap of his holster, the Nubian would take his head off at the shoulders. He found an extra turn of speed and began to catch up with Bakhshid and the other Arabs.
"Faster, Ryder, faster!"
Saffron yelped. Close behind him, he could hear the horse breathing. Ahead, the others burst through the blockhouse door. Rebecca was holding it open for him. Now she levelled the rifle and seemed to aim straight at his head. "I can't shoot without hitting you," she cried, and lowered the barrel. "Come on, Ryder, please, come on!" Even in the desperate circumstances, her use of his first name gave him a sweet thrill and added wings to his feet. He flew through the doorway, and Rebecca and Saffron slammed it behind him. On the far side, the Nubian crashed into it with a force that shivered the frame. "He's going to smash it off its hinges," Rebecca gasped. They heard the Nubian hacking and kicking at it. "Steel door, steel frame," Ryder reassured her, and grabbed the rifle Saffron handed him. He opened the breech and checked the load. "We'll be safe in here." He stepped up to the loophole, and Rebecca stood close beside him. Through the narrow opening they had a view across the yard to the door of the workshop and in the other direction to the inner gate of the menagerie. The broad, sweat-gleaming back of the Nubian appeared in their field of vision. He had abandoned his assault on the blockhouse door. Now he was riding across the yard to the barred inner gates. When he reached them, Ryder watched him lift the heavy teak locking bars and toss them aside. Then he stood back and kicked the brass lock off its hinges. As the gates swung open, the harpy was first into the yard. The horde poured in behind her. She headed straight for the blockhouse, and the rest followed her closely. It was an horrific spectacle, as though the gates of hell had burst open and spewed out the legions of the damned and long dead. Their faces were ravaged by disease and hunger, their eyes too large for their wizened, emaciated heads, their lips and eyelids swollen and inflamed with running ulcers and carbuncles. Starvation and disease emit their own odour as the body devours itself and the skin releases the fluids of decay and dissolution. As they crowded to the loopholes, the stench oozed through into the hot, airless interior and filled it with the reek of open sepulchres. It was a miasma that was difficult to breathe. The ruined faces leered and grimaced through the openings. "Food! Where is the food?" They thrust their arms through. Their limbs were thin and gnarled as dead branches. The palms of their hands were as pale as the bellies of dead fish. "Oh, Jesus, have mercy on us," Rebecca gasped, and shrank against Ryder, instinctively seeking his protection. He placed one arm round her shoulders. This time she made no effort to pull away from him. "What will happen to us now?" "Whatever happens, I will stay with you," he said, and she pressed closer to him. The harpy was shrieking orders to the mob. "Search all the buildings! We must find where they have hidden the Dara. Then we will smash the pots in which they have brewed the devil's manna. It is evil, an offence in the sight of God. It is this that has brought misfortune upon the city and visited us with pestilence and disaster. Find where they have hidden the animals. You shall feast on sweet meat this day." Her shrill voice reached to the depths of their starved bodies. They responded to her with a kind of blind, hypnotic obedience and rushed away from the rifle slits so that Ryder could see out again. He and Rebecca pressed their faces to the same opening, breathing the cleaner air and watching the hordes streaming towards the gates of the menagerie, led by the colossal Nubian and the harpy.
"Well, them bongos of yours ain't going to be shitting on the decks of my ship again, Skipper," said Jock McCrump lugubriously. Suddenly he remembered his manners and touched the brim of his cap to Rebecca. "If you'll forgive me, French ladies."
"What are they going to do with them, Jock?" Saffron's voice was fearful.
"It's the cooking pot for all of them, beasties, do you ken, Miss Saffy?"
Saffron flew at the door and tried to tear open the locking bars.
"Lucy! I have to save Lucy and her baby!"
Ryder took her arm gently but firmly and drew her to his side.
"Saffron," he whispered huskily, "there is nothing we can do for Lucy now."
"Can't you stop them, please? Won't you stop them, Ryder?"
There was no reply he could give her. He held the two girls tightly, Saffron on one side and Rebecca on the other. They clung to him and watched some of the mob crowd the gate that led to the menagerie and try to break in, but it was stout and resisted their efforts. Then the Nubian shouldered them aside. He braced himself against the gate and shook it until it rattled in its frame.
but it did not give way. He stepped back, charged, and crashed into it with one massive shoulder. The hinges were torn from the frame, and the door flew open. Ali, the old keeper, stood in the open doorway with a rusty sword in his hand.
"Oh, Ali, you old fool!"
Ryder groaned and tried to turn the girls away so that they would not see what was going to happen. But they resisted and stared ashen-faced through the loophole. Ali raised the sword above his head.
"Be gone, all of you! You will not enter here!"
His voice was high-pitched and quavering.
"I will not allow you to touch my darlings!"
He hobbled towards the giant, threatening him with the dented weapon. The bone cruncher shot out one thick arm and seized the old man's sword wrist. He shook it as a terrier shakes a rat, and they heard the bone of the old man's forearm crack. The rusty sword dropped into the dust at his feet. Using the broken arm as a handle, the bone cruncher lifted Ali's wriggling body above his head and slammed him into the jamb of the gate with such force that his ribs snapped like dry kindling. He dropped the broken body and stepped over it. The crowd rushed after him into the menagerie, but as they passed they hacked at Ali's head with a club or sword. A great roar of greed and hunger went up from within the menagerie as the mob saw the rows of cages and the terrified animals they contained.
"Food! Meat!" screamed the harpy. "I promised you a feast of fresh red meat. It is here for you."
She rushed at the nearest cage and tore open the door. It was filled with scarlet and grey parrots, a swirling, screeching cloud of wings. She leapt in and slashed at them with the whisk, knocking them to the floor of the cage and stamping on them with both horny feet. The crowd followed her example, breaking open the monkey cages and clubbing the terrified occupants as they bounded around. Then they attacked the stockades and pens of the antelope. In the blockhouse they could hear what was happening. Above the crash of breaking cages and the uproar of the mob, Saffron was able to identify the terrified voices of her favourite creatures, the shrieks of the parrots and the howls of the monkeys.
That's Lucy, my poor darling Lucy, she sobbed. They can't eat her. Tell me they won't eat Lucy.
Ryder hugged her but could find no words of comfort. Then there came wild bleating and bellows of pain from the larger animals.
"That's Victoria, my bongo," Saffron struggled again. "Let me go! Please, I have to save her!"
The female bongo bounded out through the gates of the menagerie, where old Ali's corpse still lay in the bloody dust. She must have escaped from her pen, as the mob tore it down and seemed unhurt.
"Run, Victoria!" Saffron screamed. "Run, my baby!"
A dozen men and women ran after her with spears and swords. The large, strikingly coloured animal saw the open gate ahead of her and swerved towards it, her sleek hide glistening dark chestnut with creamy white stripes, ears pricked forward, eyes filled with terror, huge and dark in her lovely head. She had almost reached the open gate when one of the spearmen checked and swivelled his shoulders, his left hand pointing straight at her, the right cocked back and holding the spear. He swung his weight forward, and the spear flew in a high arc, then dropped towards the animal. It struck her just forward of the croup, and the spearhead buried itself. The point must have struck the spine, for her paralysed hindquarters dropped, and she stood still on her front legs. A triumphant howl went up from the hunters, and they crowded round the maimed animal. They made no effort to put her out of her misery, but hacked off lumps of her living flesh. The Nubian rushed up and with a sweep of his sword opened her belly as if it were a purse. The pale bag of her stomach and the entwined ropes of entrails bulged out through the gash. These were delicacies, and the mob dragged them out of her and devoured them voraciously. The yellow contents of the unclean guts mingled with the blood and dribbled from their lips and jowls as they chewed. Rebecca gagged at the sight and turned away her face. But Saffron watched until at last the bongo collapsed, and the crowd swarmed over her carcass like a flock of vultures hiding it from view. From the gates of the menagerie, others ran out, carrying bleeding lumps of meat and the battered carcasses of the birds and monkeys. They tried to escape before the latecomers from the city streets joined in.
They were too late. And all across the compound, vicious squabbles and fighting broke out. Saffron saw one of the children pounce upon a scrap. He stuffed it into his mouth and tried to swallow it. But the woman who had dropped it set upon him, beating him and pummeled him until he was forced to spit it out. Before she could pick it out of the dust, someone else snatched it and ran out of the gates with the woman chasing after her. Another group broke down the door of the shed that contained the day's cooking of green cake. They gathered up slabs in their shirts, but before they could make off with it, the harpy fell upon them. She seemed to have risen above the simple need to find food, and ran among them, striking at random with her whisk, screaming,
"That is the poison of Shaitan! Throw it on the fire! Throw it into the latrines where it belongs!"
Although a few ran off with their booty, the harpy forced most to fling their share into the cooking fires or down the latrine pits.
"She has destroyed it all. What a shameful waste," Rebecca cried in anguish. "And she is making them smash our cauldrons. Now we shall all starve."
Ryder watched the harpy helplessly. He saw how dangerous this raving demagogue was, that at any moment she might trigger another explosion of murderous passion and insanity. However, most of the mob had disappeared, and it seemed that the riot must soon die of its own accord. Even though the damage they had wrecked was punishing, Ryder sought some small comfort in the fact that they were making no effort to take the ivory. It was clearly too heavy to carry far. Most of his other valuable possessions were locked in the strongroom in the blockhouse. Just as soon as the intrepid Ibis was seaworthy again, he would load what was left of them and be ready for instant flight. But the harpy was still prowling round the yard and stopping every few minutes to shake her whisk at the blockhouse and scream curses and insults at the white faces she could see watching her from the loopholes. When she paused at the door of the workshop, Ryder was not seriously alarmed. Some of the other looters had gone in, but had soon come out again. There was nothing in there for them to eat, nothing of obvious value for them to carry away. However, the harpy was in the workshop for only a minute before she rushed out and screamed across the yard for the Nubian wrestler. Like a tame gorilla responding to its trainer, he crossed the yard with his massive rolling gait. She led him into the workshop, where the Nubian came out again, and he was carrying this time such a heavy burden that his legs were bowed under its weight.
"Oh, look!"
shouted Jock in consternation. It was a burden that would have taken the strength of 5 ordinary men, but the Nubian was carrying the main steam pipe from the intrepid Ibis. Jock had laboured over this piece of machinery for months, and now it was ready to reinstall in the steamer. The harpy screeched towards the blockhouse.
"You think to escape the wrath of the Mahdi? You think to run away in your little steamer? We are going to throw this thing into the Nile. When the Mahdi comes, your white and leprous corpses will rot in the streets of Khartoum. Even vultures will not eat them."
She drove the giant Nubian like an ox towards the gates. "Even he can never carry that to the river," Ryder exclaimed. But the harpy was now shouting for others to help him. A number were hurrying to his aid.
"I give him a solemn oath that he's taking my steam pipe nowhere," Jock growled.
He swung up the Martini Henry, and the crash of the shot in the narrow confines of the room numbed their ears. The rifle kicked back, and the sweet stink of black powder smoke stung their nostrils. The Nubian had reached the gates. He was less than 60 yards from the rifle slit. The heavy lead bullet caught him just behind the ear and angled forward through his brain. In a pink cloud of wet tissue, it burst out through the right eye socket. He collapsed, with the weight of the steampipe chest pinning his corpse to the sun-baked clay.
"You killed him," Ryder exclaimed in disbelief.
"I aimed at him, didn't I?"
Jock said brusquely.
"Of course I damn well killed him."
With his calloused thumb, he pushed another cartridge into the breech of the rifle.
"And I'm going to kill anybody else who touches me engine."
In the yard, there was an abrupt and breathless silence. The rioters had almost forgotten the presence of the white prisoners in the blockhouse. They stared at the huge, half-naked corpse in awe. The harpy was the only one not bereft of the power of movement. She snatched an axe out of the hands of the man nearest to her and rushed at the length of pipe. One of the many duties of a Sudanese woman
is to cut the firewood for her household. As the first stroke of the axe clanged against his steam-pipe, Jock knew she was an expert. She swung the axe again and hit exactly the same spot. Jock could see that she was aiming at one of his welds. The metal there would be annealed by the heat of his torch. Already it was buckling. Two or three blows like that, and she would puncture and distort it. It might take days to repair the damage she had already done. If he didn't do something to stop her, she might inflict damage beyond repair.
"We'll have no more of that nonsense," he muttered.
Ryder saw him lift the rifle again.
"Don't shoot!" he shouted. "Jock, don't shoot her!"
"Too late," said Jock, without the least note of contrition in his voice, and again the Martini Henry bucked and bellowed in his hands. The bullet caught the harpy full in the chest. It picked her off her feet and threw her against the wall. She hung there, her mouth wide open, but the scream was trapped forever in her throat. Then she slid down the wall, leaving a long, bright smear on the whitewash. The remaining rioters stared in consternation at the bodies of the two ringleaders. Retribution had come swiftly and unexpectedly. When would the next shot crash out, and who would fall? A wail of alarm went up, and they rushed for the gates. "Keep them on the run!" Ryder had resigned himself to making the most of Jock's precipitate action. He snatched up his own rifle and fired over the heads of the rioters. Within minutes the yard was empty, except for the harpy and her Nubian. Ryder opened the blockhouse door cautiously and called to Rebecca.
"Keep Saffron in here with you until we know it's safe for you to come out."
With rifles loaded and held at high port, ready to get off a quick shot, the men swept the compound to make certain no danger still lurked. Jock hurried directly to his steam-pipe and knelt beside it. He peered anxiously at the axe marks on the metal, removed the greasy and battered cap from his head, and polished the marred surface tenderly. Then he replaced his cap and studied the marks again. He sighed with relief.
"Well, I don't think there's too much damage done there."
He picked up the whole pipe as easily as the Nubian had, and carried it lovingly back into his workshop. Ryder walked over to the two corpses. The harpy was sitting with her back against the wall. Her eyes and her mouth were open, and her expression was faintly quizzical. He prodded her with the toe of his boot. She flopped onto her face and lay still. He could have fitted his clenched fist into the deep, dark bullet hole between her shoulder blades. He did not need to examine the Nubian. His head lay in a puddle of his own brains.
"I don't approve, but that was not bad shooting, Jock," he muttered, then called to Bakshit.
"Dump them in the river. The crocodiles will take care of them. No need to report this. Gordon Pasha is a busy man. We don't want to give him any more to worry about than he already has." He waited until Bakshit and his Arabs had dragged the bodies out of the yard and through the gates that led to the canal. Then he went back to the blockhouse and opened the door. "All is safe. You may come out." Saffron rushed past him and darted to the menagerie gates. Old Ali lay curled beside the gatepost. He had been her friend. He had loved the animals as much as she did, and he had taught her how to care for them. She knelt beside his body. In the months since the beginning of the siege, she had been exposed to death in many of its most hideous forms, but now she gagged as she looked at her friend's body. The rioters had battered his head until it was shapeless, no longer recognizable as human.
"Poor Ali," she whispered.
"You died for your animals.
God will love you for that."
She found his blood-soaked turban and covered his face.
"Go in peace," she said in Arabic.
She left him and went on into the menagerie. There she stopped again. She gazed around at the devastation, and her knees went weak under her. Every cage had been smashed open, and every one of the animals was gone. Clouds of blue flies hummed over puddles of their blood that were drying and caking in the desert sun. With an effort, Saffron steeled herself and went on down the rows of empty cages.
"Lucy,"
she called as she went, and she imitated the chittering sound that was the monkey's special recognition call.
"Billy, Billy, Billy, baby, where are you?"
She reached Lucy's cage. The door had been torn off, and the cage was deserted. She stood before it grieving.
She had been so young when her mother died that she could barely remember it, but she knew she had not felt as bereaved as she did now.
"They couldn't have done this. It's so cruel."
She knew that if she stood there longer she would start to blubber and her father would be ashamed of her. There was only one other place in the menagerie to search. She went to the feed shed at the far end of the enclosure.
"Lucy," she called. "Billy, where are you, my baby?"
She peered into the gloom. "Billy!" She made the chittering monkey sound, and a tiny, dark shape shot out from behind a pile of straw. With a single bound it landed on her hip, climbed onto her shoulder, and chittered softly in reply to her call.
"Billy," whispered Saffron, "you're safe."
She sank to the floor and hugged the small furry body to her chest. Despite everything her father had told her, she began to cry and could not stop.